Open your Bibles and turn on your brains. It's time for the Think Theism Podcast.
Can the existence of God be demonstrated?
I'm convinced that there are better arguments for theism than for atheism.
Isn't any contradiction between the existence of evil and God's being holy, good, and not?
The biggest difference, of course, winds up being who is Jesus and what role does he have?
Howdy, welcome to another episode of Think Theism, the Apologetics and Theology podcast at Texas A&M. I am Zachary Lawson. I'm joined by co-host and irreducibly complex man, Andrew Robbins.
Hi there.
You'll notice that our sound sounds wonderful today. This is because we are being graciously hosted by Red Sea Catholic Radio. Go to redsearadio.org to show your appreciation. And our guest today probably needs no introduction. He's the author of Darwin's Black Box and widely considered to be the father of the intelligent design movement, Dr. Michael Behe. How are you doing, Dr. Behe?
Great. It's wonderful to be with you folks.
All right. So you are in Aggieland for the Veritas Forum, which will be later today. Is this your first time in College Station?
Well, it's first time in a while. I was here, maybe 2 decades ago, but I hear things have changed since.
just a tad. So the topic for tonight is God and or evolution. Now, that title I pick because it's clickbait, but what's going to be sort of your general position during the conversation tonight?
Well, my position is going to be that much of biology, and particularly at the molecular level, shows signs of having been purposely, intelligently designed. Mm-hmm. That is, it did not, Darwinian mechanisms, evolutionary mechanisms are not sufficient to explain it.
You jumped on the scene almost 25 years ago now, in 1996, with this book right here, Darwin's Black Box. Started a bit of a firestorm, to say the least.
Just a bit.
And then that was followed up with another book, The Edge of Evolution. And now you have a new book, Darwin Devolves, which was released, I believe, last year. So what has been sort of the broad overview of these three books? So Darwin's Black Box was the irreducible complexity book. That's what I remember it as.
Right.
So what's kind of been the general move with these three books? And then where does Darwin Devolves fit in your overall project?
Well, I started out with Darwin's Black Box, which gives people a tour of what biochemistry has found in the cell. The black box of the title is supposed to be the cell because it was unknown to Charles Darwin and his contemporaries. They didn't know what was contained in it. And I showed that it contains all these complex machines, well, that science has discovered, and that some of them are irreducibly complex. And that just means they need all their parts to work, and so they can't be put together gradually. So that's a big problem for Darwin. And I argued that a better conclusion is that they were purposely, intelligently designed. Mm-hmm. So that kicked it off. And then for the next two books, they pursued the question, well, if some things in life are purposely designed, and not everything is, I mean, there's no reason to think that the shape of your nose is specifically designed, then where is it reasonable to draw a line between those two? I call that the edge of evolution. That was the title of the second book. And I argued in the second book that, well, it's at least reasonable to draw the edge of evolution at the level of class. And that invertebrates is fish and birds and mammals and so on. In the latest book, I address the same question, but with newer science results. And there's been a revolution in the ability of science to sequence DNA. And you have to do that to track down the mutations that natural selection can select, because mutations are changes in molecules and ultimately in DNA. And the book title is Darwin Devolves, and that reflects the surprising fact that most of the beneficial mutations that natural selection selects that help the organism survive in a different environment are degradations or breaking of pre-existing genes. They're not the making of genes. And so I argue that that's going to overwhelm any constructive process that Darwinian mechanism might have.
I appreciate right here at the very front of the book, you have your key thesis statement. The first rule of adaptive evolution is to break or blunt any functional gene whose loss would increase the number of a species' offspring.
Exactly. And the reason for that is because it's easy to break stuff. Mm-hmm. And if by breaking stuff you can have some effect which will help an organism, then that'll be the first effect to come along. So it will be selected and it'll quickly pass through the species. Just as an example, suppose there were a brown bunny rabbit and the environment started to change and it started to snow more where it was, and it would be helpful for the rabbit to have white fur. Well, one mutation that would be expected to come along much more quickly than constructive one is a break in genes that are responsible for making the pigmentation of the fur. Mm-hmm. And that would be selected. That would help, but it would be a degradation or breaking of a pre-existing gene, not a construction of something new.
Mm-hmm. And presumably then biological complexity requires the acquisition of more complex and increasing as opposed to decreasing and degradation.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. As I wrote in Darwin's Black Box, you've got these phenomenally complex machines, mm-hmm. and they're not going to be built by a degradative process.
Yeah. I was actually hoping, you know, you made the bacterial flagellum like a household icon of intelligent design. Just to bring some of our listeners up to speed, could you kind of summarize why you think the bacterial flagellum was or is like the poster child of intelligent design?
Well, it's great because you can immediately see in the structure of the machine itself its design. Mm-hmm. For folks who don't know about it, the flagellum is an outboard motor that bacteria use to swim, and it's got all sorts of mechanical parts. It's got a rotor and a propeller and a drive shaft and a hook joint or a universal joint and all sorts of stuff. And in an electron microscope, scientists can look and you can see these parts. And so with those images or drawings of them, I use that as the frontispiece for Darwin's Black Box, because when you look at it, you immediately realize this was designed. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because you see all these parts that were put together for a purpose. So it in a picture is worth a thousand words.
Oh, for sure. But I think the key point there being that if you take away even one part, it's not like it's a slightly worse flagellum. It's just not a flagellum anymore.
That's correct. So that's what I termed irreducibly complex. And mm-hmm. complex, and it's irreducible because you can't take anything away from it. And I use an everyday analogy to explain that concept, a mouse trap, a mechanical mouse trap you might buy at a hardware store. Mm-hmm. It needs all of its parts to work. You take away the spring or the little hammer that hits the mouse, and it's not that it works half as well. It doesn't work at all. It's mm-hmm. broken. So. Yeah. You can imagine that's a big problem if you're looking for a way to put that together gradually, because you don't get the function pretty much until it's complete. Mm-hmm.
So that was about 25 years ago, and a lot of people were very not happy with that. So 25-ish years later, how does it hold up, do you think? How much do you think you've changed your mind since Darwin's Black Box, and how much do you think has withstood the scrutiny?
Well, in my completely unbiased opinion, yeah. It has all stood up. That's not to say there haven't been criticisms and people pointing to different things that they think do not comport with my arguments. But in my own humble opinion, I wouldn't change a word of Darwin's Black Box. And the only thing I would change is there are sections where I write that I think Darwinian processes can make, you know, certain molecules like hemoglobin and so on. I have grown even less fond of Darwin's mechanisms. I think mm-hmm. it can't do things for purposes of argument, granted in mm-hmm. Darwin's Black Box.
So if anything, Darwin's Black Box may be a little too friendly for Darwinism nowadays.
That's right. But, it, you know, science advances quickly, so it's
always never
a snapshot.
Yeah. So the bacterial flagellum, the blood clotting cascades, another example you've used. I don't think we have time to go through all of them. But I'm just curious, are there any examples that you think are bad examples of intelligent design? As in, not bad design, but like someone has said, ah, here's intelligent design, but they just went all wrong about it.
There is one in particular, and I actually differ with some folks who are colleagues of mine in the ID movement, and that is on something called junk DNA. In the past decades, a lot of DNA has been discovered in cells of advanced organisms, eukaryotic cells, that doesn't code for proteins. Proteins are the machinery of cells. And people didn't know what it did. So some Darwinians said, well, it probably doesn't do anything. It just, you know, it collects by random processes. Maybe when DNA is duplicating, a section kind of accidentally gets duplicated a couple times. And it's junk. It just accumulates over time. And some people friendly to IDs, I'm getting ahead of myself. Yeah. Later on, it was discovered, wait a second, you know, this piece here that we thought was junk, it turns out to have a function. And then a little bit later, wait, this went over too. This has a function. And and these days you're getting lots of reports of function on what was thought to be junk DNA. It's never a good idea to bet against something having a function in biology. Well, after this started to happen, In my view, some ID proponents kind of retrospectively said, well, hey, this is just what you would expect on an intelligent design view. And I disagree with that. I think the ID view doesn't really say much of anything about junk DNA. I don't think the Darwinian theory says much about junk DNA. I think it's kind of neutral. And you have people arguing back and forth for the same thing. So I don't think that's a good idea. That's a bad design argument.
Okay. So if someone says, we see that junk DNA was at one time thought to be functionless, but now it does have function. Ah, this is exactly what you would expect on intelligent design.
Yeah.
Then why didn't they say that before the evidence came forward?
Yeah. Okay. These retrospective predictions are always suspect.
Yeah. That is kind of interesting. So one thing I'm curious about, I know that in general, a biological principle is to use as minimal energy as possible. So if there were junk DNA, it seems to me, again, not a biochemist, but it seems to me that you would expect that that would be trimmed out of the genome rather than being maintained with all this excessive energy.
Yeah, you would, but there are kind of fine details where it depends on the population size and the odds of trimming good stuff out with the bad. And so it's a little convoluted, but other things being equal, you're right.
Okay. So one other thing, too, following after Darwin's black box, and that started a huge national conversation about intelligent design, creationism, the role of God in the classroom, and I think that pretty much culminated in the 2004 Kitzmiller versus Dover trial, in which you were a witness. In that. So one of the elements that came out, one of the things the prosecution mentioned, which I think whoever was against intelligent design, I don't remember who it was, prosecution or defense, but
yeah, they were the plaintiffs.
Okay. Hard for me to keep track. But one of the quotes they pulled up was from a guy at the Discovery Institute, friend of the show, Paul Nelson, who we've actually interviewed before, asked about this quote too. But one of the things that he said was, quote, easily the biggest challenge facing the intelligent design community is to develop a full-fledged theory of biological design. We don't have such a theory right now, and that's a real problem. Without such a theory, it's very hard to know where to direct your research focus. Right now, we've got a bag of powerful intuitions and a handful of notions, such as irreducible complexity, but as yet, no general theory of biological design. Now, Paul said that 15 years later, that's probably not true. So I wanted to get your take on this. Did you think it was true in 2005? And do you think intelligent design is in a much better position now than it was whenever it was litigated?
Well, let me first start off by saying Paul Nelson is a really great guy and very friendly. I've known him for 25 years, but I think he was wrong on this.
Okay.
That I don't think you need a general theory of intelligent design to make conclusions, just like you don't need a general theory of Rembrandt or his psychology to know that work of his was painted, which was purposely made. The intuitions, I think that would be a bad word to use. I think we can strongly reach conclusions of design by looking at the objects that we suspect were designed. You look at Mount Rushmore as a classic example. Nobody, even if they had never heard of it before, would think that that was an accidental arrangement of rocks. I'm not even sure it depends on what you mean by a comprehensive theory of design. Of course, when you're talking about design, you're talking about an intelligent being that's doing stuff. And even, you know, we people are very hard to predict. So it would be hard to get a general theory. Nonetheless, as I have written, you can do a number of things. And one thing is try to delimit what requires design, what requires arrangement versus what could be accomplished by just random changes in natural selection or whatever other evolutionary process that you want to invoke. And I think that we have made progress there, especially I think with the more recent work in science where mutations are able to be tracked and followed. And we found out that, in fact, this Darwinian mechanism is actually strongly devolutionary. So I think in spite of itself, the scientific community is helping to set up a more broad theory of design.
So building off of that idea, some people say that if you critique the modern synthesis or neo-Darwinism or what have you, that you're probably just an intelligent design person trying to sneak God into things. But like you said, there have been, you know, real biologists, even atheistic biologists with no dog in the fight at all, that have been challenging some of the limits of the modern synthesis, sometimes called neo-Darwinism. I understand there's a distinction between them, but I'm not totally sure what it is.
They're used and the terms are used pretty much interchangeably.
So one of them is this book here, Evolution, the Extended Synthesis. This came out about 10 years ago now. And it's basically just a compendium of scientists writing articles saying there's some deficiency within the Darwinian scheme as it is, or I'll say the modern synthesis to be consistent here. And specifically, the stated deficiencies being gene centrism, gradualism, and externalism. Now, I don't know what all those mean, but gradualism is what you've definitely focused on for sure. And I was actually struck by this quote here. I cannot pronounce the gentleman's name. Massimo Pigliucci, I believe is how it's pronounced. And he has this really fascinating quote right here, and I'd like to read it. He said, underlying the shift toward a causal mechanistic approach in evolutionary theory is a hugely expanded knowledge base consisting of large data sets in genetics, development, plasticity, inheritance, and other empirical domains. While the modern synthesis, in the absence of such data, had to contend with black boxing all mechanistic aspects. And thus, the modern synthesis was unable to explain how organismal change is realized at the phenotypic level. The organism, as an explanandum, has returned through the extended accounts. Now, if I read that and did not know it was in this book, I could have thought that came from an intelligent design person.
Yeah, that's right. Surprisingly, probably a good chunk of biologists are skeptical of Darwin's theory these days. I'd guess a third of them. The more you get into evolutionary biology, the more skeptical numbers you find. And that's because they're having trouble fitting what science has discovered in recent decades into Darwin's theory. So there's a couple of comments one can make. First is that the public rarely hears of that. Mm-hmm. Whenever a challenge is raised to evolution, then all the wagons are circled. And the public is told that Darwin everybody knows that Darwin solved the problems now and forever. So please, nothing to see here. Just go back and go back to your homes. And that's not the case. I mean, that's simply not the case. Even professional biologists who have no love at all for intelligent design think Darwin's theory is in need of help. The second thing to say is that the large data sets that Massimo Piliucci is speaking of don't give any help to explaining how organisms could evolve. You ask, you know, what are these data sets telling you about, how birds got feathers? Well, I don't know. And how do they explain the bacterial flagellum? Well, I don't know. Mm-hmm. There are proponents and they're pushing this idea. But right now, for my money, I think Darwinism explains more stuff in biology than do the processes that extended evolutionary synthesis people cite.
So as I understand it, they accept all of Darwinism, and then they're adding on additional things to that. Would that be correct?
Well, that kind of shifts depending on
it depends on
the audience and who's speaking. Yeah, some say, oh, yeah, we don't want to – we just want to add a few little things to it. But then behind closed doors, they'll say, you know, we have to throw this Darwinism out root and branch.
Okay, yeah. It's interesting you said that – whenever these types of critiques come up, the public never knows about it. I mean, this book's almost 11 years old. I'd never heard of it. Uh-huh. Seems like it would be, you know, headline news.
Yeah.
And now, to some extent, that did happen with the, I guess, about 4 years ago with the Royal Society meeting on this. Was that kind of in the same vein as the extended synthesis people? I definitely recognize some names were overlapping.
Yes. The Royal Society, which is a scientific society in England, kind of comparable to our National Academy of Sciences, they sponsor meetings, a bunch of meetings every year. And one of them was on alternative approaches to evolution or some such title, in which, folks who are advocates of these alternative approaches – such as something called niche construction and symbiosis and things that generally aren't talked about in neo-Darwinian circles. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were the main constituents of the meeting attendees. And it got a lot of press ahead of time because people were saying, strange anti-scientific attitude seeping into the Royal Society. And during the meeting, I did not attend, but I heard firsthand accounts, people spoke for these other mechanisms, but everyone was at pains to say, we're all getting along here. No, we're not trying to overthrow Darwin. There's clearly a lot of social pressure around this issue, not only in public, not only in, say, school battles and school boards, but also in professional societies.
Mm-hmm. So I think one question that would be helpful here for those of us that are outside the guild is this extended synthesis, and to what extent is it really like a competitor with intelligent design? Because one could basically say neo-Darwinism is falling apart, there are deficiencies, and you've got basically two schools of thought. You either have intelligent design or the extended synthesis. So one question is, to what extent are they competing? And then to the second question, what if God designed these mechanisms, you know, or the intelligent designer?
Well, you might get different answers, but since you're asking me, I think they don't compete at all.
Okay.
I think the extended synthesis does, you know, raise interesting questions, and there are factors which affect organisms that people hadn't been paying attention to. One interesting one is something called niche construction. Mm-hmm. That is that Darwinism says that organisms have to adapt to their surroundings, but a lot of organisms modify their surroundings.
Yeah, like beavers even. Yeah.
Exactly, okay. Yeah. And one that's been studied is termites. Termites build big mounds that affect how well they survive and so on. That's interesting, but that doesn't tell you where termites came from in the first place or beavers or any such thing. So the ideas of the extended evolutionary synthesis, for the most part, are all fine and they're not out of there, and they certainly have a place in biology, but they are not going to answer the question of how complex systems arose in life.
So my question is, what is the ultimate goal of intelligent design in terms of interacting with the more traditional scientific community? Is the goal to have agent causation as an acceptable explanation of scientifically observed of things in the scientific record? Is it to have God allowed as an explanation for things? And then kind of on the other side of that, how do you respond to the criticism that it's just a God of the gaps argument?
I think the goal is, yes, to have agent causation be a legitimate explanation. That is to say that, well, where did the bacterial flagellum come from? And you'd say, I don't know who the agent is. I don't know what processes he, she, or it might have used. But it was caused by an intelligent agent. I want that to be kind of the dominant idea in evolutionary science and biology. Number one, because I think it's true. And science is, of course, supposed to describe the world as it is, not as we wish it should be. And if it is true, then it should be more fruitful than banging your head against the wall with theories of unintelligent processes building up complex machinery. The question, why is this not a God of the gaps? Well, it's interesting. God of the gaps says, well, whenever you don't understand something, well, then you insert God in there. He must have done it. It turns out that we're not invoking intelligence or a designer because of ignorance. We're invoking it because of knowledge. Back in Darwin's day, when the cell was thought to be a little blob of jelly, protoplasm, it was a whole lot easier to think that cells could kind of mold themselves into any shape that they needed and grow up to be organisms or eyes or whatever. But with the discovery of science of the complexity of the cell, the fact that DNA carries tons of information, that there are sophisticated machines in the cell, literally machines made out of molecules, then that is what intelligent design is based on. These are marks of minds. Minds make machines. Minds, can convey information. So I think that, in fact, intelligent design is based on our progress in science. And on the flip side, I would say that in my days, I've run across a lot of people who say, yeah, you guys raise good questions, but give us another 30 years, another 40 years, and then we'll figure it out. And that's, I think, a Darwin of the gaps. They're assuming the answer, not based on the evidence we have, but what they want to see become true.
So I think also there's kind of a related question to this is, if you see the signature of a intelligent designer in the creation of life on Earth, for example, how do you integrate that with kind of causal mechanisms? Because we can certainly say that there are situations, at least within the Christian worldview, where we believe God acted but used natural means of different kinds. So how do you kind of fall on this spectrum from kind of a miraculous intervention or providential intervention? Say, you know, a random event occurs that was unlikely, but it's not actually outside of the productive capacity of nature, as opposed to a zap miracle, you know, flagellum appears.
Well, the things that we see in biochemistry, in my own view, are things that could not fall under the rubric of providential. When I hear providential, I think of, yeah, you know, God knew it was going to happen. But as you say, it's kind of within the purview of nature. These aren't in the purview of nature, unless you're going to say, you know, that God set up the universe specifically to allow many, many coincidences to come together at some particular moment. And that I would not call providence. I would call that design, because these were intentionally arranged to give rise to molecular machinery. So I am not arguing that God, that there had to be some creative event, some ex nihilo outside of nature, puff of smoke sort of thing, and there you have a flagellum. I'm happy to think that the information was packed into the universe from the beginning and did in fact unfold over time. I'm not saying it did, but I'm saying I have no particular reason to reject that, certainly not philosophical. But even if that were the case, it would be design, and we can still tell it is design when we observe the systems themselves, the ones in our modern world, where we see this incredibly precise and functional, purposeful arrangement of parts. That's exactly how we detect design. That's exactly how we recognize the work of a mind. Mm-hmm. We understand that minds work. You know, we can't read minds. So the only way we can determine intelligence or the degree of intelligence is by the arrangements, the work that the mind has done with physical things that we can perceive with our senses.
I think something that may be a helpful clarification here is people often will equate evolution with the general idea of just common descent. Mm-hmm. But the way that you just described intelligent design is completely consistent with some, you know, bacterium sharing an ancestor with something that didn't have a flagellum. But at some point, the parts, you know, almost like a series of dominoes through the generations, eventually assembled into a flagellum. So it sounds to me like common descent, common ancestry, and intelligent design are not really that incompatible.
No, not at all. There is nothing in intelligent design per se that says the designer couldn't have designed by using descent. You know, so what? Big deal. You know, who am I going to? I'm not going to be able to tell this designer what to do. You know. Mm-hmm. Can do what he wants. I should say that I am noted among intelligent design proponents as one of the few who says, you know, common descent, you know, it looks persuasive to me. Mm-hmm. I have no problem with it. But I like to use an analogy that a while back when my kids would go to McDonald's, would get a little transformer type toy with a Happy Meal, and you take it out and it looked like a hamburger, and you pull it open and it turns into a robot or something. and that's cool, but the transformation did not happen by accident. It was planned, okay. It was designed, it was built in. I certainly don't know how it could be, but when you're talking about an intelligent designer, especially one who is the degree of intelligence that we see in life, you know, you certainly can't rule out a priority that the designer set up life to unfold, but yet, yeah, everything was prearranged.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier about how in The Edge of Evolution, and I presume as well in Darwin Devolves, you mentioned that the limit of evolution is right around the level of class, I believe. So,
yeah, I changed my mind in the most recent book. Now I think it's much deeper than, and I kind of put it at the level of family. Mm-hmm. And class was birds versus fish, and family is cats versus dogs. Mm-hmm. So it's much deeper into biology. So that I mean by that, that you could not get a cat and a dog from some generic ancestor mammal. You would have to put information, active information, into to specify those families.
Okay, so if I understand correctly on this hypothesis of the designer, quote-unquote, programming life, life could start and then develop with a lot of information infusion at the beginning, and then once you get all the way down to the family level, that's whenever the Darwinian mechanisms are sufficient.
That's pretty much right. You're below the family level.
Okay.
The species and genus are the two levels below family.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, sure, it turns out, people can get confused with the idea of species, but, Darwin talked about the origin of species, and some people think of species as major classes of organism, but that's the lowest level of biological classification.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get species that separate, or populations of, say, butterflies. Some fly to the left and others fly to the right, and they get separated for a while, and changes in their DNA prevent them then from coming back and interbreeding. You got two species, but you don't have anything really new. It's just they've lost the ability to interbreed with each other. So that's not a big deal.
Mm-hmm. So on this idea of common ancestry and common descent, presumably that entails that human beings share a common ancestor with the apes and chimpanzees and whatnot. And while I understand that you are a biochemist, the question is just right there. Where do Adam and Eve fit on this picture?
That's an excellent question. And the short answer is I don't know. But a longer answer is that the difference in biochemistry between people and chimps or other primates is not really well elucidated. No, scientists don't really know why a monkey cell develops into a monkey and human cells develop into humans. Biochemistry is pretty much the same. But nonetheless, with simple observation, we can see that humans are radically different from other primates, especially in our mental abilities. We can think abstract thoughts. We have minds. We have wills and so on. So it's clear that those extra physical abilities are, in my view, required creation, required real, ex nihilo creation. The real thing. Where Adam and Eve fit in, I myself think there was a real physical Adam and Eve, the first parents of the human race. But the details I'm a little fuzzy on.
Mm-hmm.
And from the science, I've read people going back and forth on the topic. And I say, bless your hearts, let me know when you've resolved the issue.
And I mean, honestly, our other speakers tonight, Joshua Swamidas, he's written a book on the Adam and Eve question and how it fits in with evolution. And one of the things that was really kind of elucidating in his book was just how little information there really is about Adam and Eve in the Bible, and how much is just assumed to be there. People try to make the mitochondrial Eve the literal Eve of, Genesis 2, or they try to say that whatever the common ancestor was for all humanity, that's the Adam. It's like three chapters. It's only like, I think, 200 words or something. And there's just so much. Oh, and it's in Hebrew, too. It's very ancient. It's like there's so much information being just assumed on that part that, I kind of share in your position. Yeah, it looks like chromosome 2 looks like it fused, but... Man, I don't know what that tells me about Genesis 3 or 2 or what.
Yeah, same here. As I said, for theological reasons, one can hold that a real Adam and Eve are likely are required. But the science is real, real fuzzy at this stage. And exactly what it means is still an open question.
Dr. Behe, thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Again, the book is Darwin Devolves, and it is available pretty much wherever books are sold.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Think Theism is made in association with Rasha Christi at Texas A&M University. We invite you to join the weekly Rasha Christi meetings every Thursday at 8:30 p.m. For more information, go to thinktheism.org. The views and opinions that are expressed in all of our episodes are of the speakers only and are not necessarily endorsed by Rasha Christi nor by Texas A&M University.